looking forward to our second session with you.
Sure, huh?
So just to recap briefly, last time we were together, you introduced the theme, Kiriji introduced the theme of the impasse of modernity. And he introduced it by referring to a passage from the Life Divine, last chapter, The Divine Life, which I have circulated to all the participants so that they could look at it and reflect on it. In this passage, Sri Aurobindo gives a sweeping overview of the history of civilization from the early stage in sort of Hellenic civilization right up to the modern curve of reason in which we find ourselves. And he ends that passage with the present prognosis, which is that of a new kind of barbarism in which we find ourselves, finally raising the specter of the possibility of evolutionary failure. Kiriji dealt with this passage at length last time, and he also introduced the idea that it is really the work of Mother and Sri Aurobindo that has averted, in his belief, this evolutionary failure that is being referred to. But that does not mean that there is any lack of danger and difficulty in our present time. It is not a time for us to rejoice, as the mother says somewhere. So with those words, I will pass it on to Kiriji to continue his exploration and for us to share with him.
Thank you, Debashish. You have done marvelously well in summarizing what I was saying last time. I shall continue the theme, and I want to suggest that we try to make to ourselves more precise what exactly is the impasse. What that impasse means to our human effort, and how we can be benefited, the whole humanity can be benefited for its upward evolution by the tremendous work that has been accomplished by Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. I shall first of all make only a short statement by pointing out that three factors have joined together to produce the present impasse. One is the tremendous development of science and technology, with the resultant development of huge structures of organization. This has happened. And the multiplication of this hugeness is still in view. And we shall come back to this point very shortly. The second is that reason, of which science is a product, which has developed so far, finds itself to move forward. If the reason were able to race properly, the situation would have been different. But reason is unable to move fast enough. What this means, we shall again try to become more precise very shortly. And third is the emergence of the overwhelming preference for the realization of the economic aim of life. It is these three factors coming together that have caused the jam. And as I said last time, although this jam has been broken by Herculean
efforts. Sorry to interrupt you, please. What was the first one?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Pardon? First one is the development of science.
What was the first?
First factor is the development of science,
okay,
and technology, and resultant hugeness of structures of organization. This is the first factor. Is it all right? Have you been able to hear?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
So these three factors have come together. And as I said, Sri Aurobindo, the mother, have worked out a solution. And one of the aims of this exploration is to understand this tremendous work that Sri Aurobindo and the mother have accomplished. But at the moment, I'm still dwelling upon this impasse so that we understand quite well, particularly because although the work, as I said, which Sri Aurobindo and mother have accomplished is done, the future is still full of perils. And we are passing through a perilous time. And if you do not understand the impasse which still continues to press upon all of us, even though at the end of the tunnel, the blockade has been broken, but still we are passing through the tunnel, and we also need to cross many hurdles and many perils. So it is inevitable that we must understand what is this impasse which has been broken, and yet it is still strangulating all of us, and we all are struggling to come out of it. We also need to resolve in our own way. And that is why we need to understand these exact factors which are in the loop, you might say, of the impasse. Now, the hugeness of the structures does not require a long argument. It is right before us. Even the machine that we are using today, as a result of which we are able to converse with each other in spite of long distances, is one of the examples of this hugeness of the structure that is organized. In this connection, I will only refer to one very interesting book that I have come across just a few days ago, and I thought I'll just bring it to your notice and read out to you a few portions of this book. It is called The Singularity is Near. It's the title. The Singularity is Near. It is written by Ray Kurzweil. He is one of the foremost futurists of our times. And when you read a little biodata of this great futurist, this whole biodata reads like an amazing achievement for a human being to have achieved. In fact, Bill Gates has spoken of him in glowing terms, and there are many others who have acknowledged the merits of this great book. It has been published in 2005, and I'm sure in America it must be more easily available. A good friend of mine has just recently sent me a copy of it, and I happened to read a few pages, but even these few pages that I've read are very stimulating. And I thought it would be a good idea to share with you one or two important ideas which have been worked upon in this book. First of all, the subtitle of the book is When Humans Transcend Biology. And it's a very significant statement, because biology at present concerns the physiology and biological functions of our body, and of which life and death are very important phases. And transcending biology would mean transcending many limitations that our biological existence is confronted with. The circulation of blood, for example, the dependence upon breathing, dependence upon food, and the necessity of death. And these are very important concepts which are relevant also for the theme that we are going to discuss at length in due course of time. He speaks of six epochs right from the time that evolution started. And he believes that we are now in the sixth epoch. And this epoch is what he calls, let us wake up. The world wakes up. Even this title is also very interesting, and he points out that this epoch will achieve by reorganizing matter and energy to provide an optimal level of computation to spread out from its origin on Earth. This book abounds with facts and figures and diagrams and graphs. And they're all very interesting. And when you find time, if you find time and if you feel inclined, you may like to have a look at this book. And maybe at some time, Debashish also may like to speak on this subject, because this is also a part of his own specialty. So I leave at this moment this particular book. I just wanted to share with you that this book points out the possibilities of tremendous development of the hugeness of the structures that are being built up in our own times. Actually, he believes that a time is not very, very far off when human brain can produce a machine which will be super brain, and then super brain will, on the contrary, affect our biological development. It is a kind of a statement illustrating McLuhan's statement, who said that we make tools and then make us. Well, I'm not going to discuss this book, nor its thesis. So this is the first point that I would like to make, that there is a hugeness of structure, and I would like to underline it. The question is, how are we going to deal with this structure? How are we going to deal even with the increasing development of hugeness of the structure? And as I said, it would have been much better and much easier if the highest instrument of human consciousness, namely reason, were able to aid in our task, and that is not happening. And apart from this important instrument which you call reason, there is another factor in human consciousness to which we must pay due attention. And many writers who speak of the future, they do not take into account this important factor on which Sri Aurobindo has dwelt at length. And that is a factor of the ego of the man. What is ego? What is the role that ego plays in the development of evolution? As Sri Aurobindo said at one time, ego is the helper and ego is the bar. And we know that ego has been a helper. All psychologists will agree with their statements. But we do not realize that one of the most important factors that is blocking the way to a future development and the way by which our dangers can be minimized is to lead our own development to such a point where ego reaches a vanishing point. I do not know if you remarked at one time in the Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo has, this is in volume number 18, and this is in chapter number 2, Life Divine, chapter number 2, the two negations, the materialist denial, where also Sri Aurobindo speaks of the development of hugeness of structures of organization. And what he has said there is extremely significant. And we must remember that Sri Aurobindo wrote this in 1914-1915. And at that time, how he had perceived the development of the future, an immediate future, and how prophetic these words are. And let me read out to you this particular passage from the Life Divine. This is on page number 15 in the 1971 edition, that is centenary edition. Sri Aurobindo says, as the outposts of scientific knowledge come more and more to be set on the borders that divide the material from the immaterial, so also the highest achievements of practical science are those which tend to simplify and reduce to the vanishing point the machinery by which the greatest effects are produced. Wireless telegraphy is nature's exterior sign and pretext for a new orientation. The sensible physical means for the intermediate transmission of the physical force is removed. It is only preserved at the points of impulsion and reception. Eventually, even these must disappear, for when the laws and forces of the supraphysical are studied with the right starting point, the means will infallibly be found for mind directly to seize on the physical energy and speed it accurately upon its errand. There, once we bring ourselves to recognize it, lie the gates that open upon the enormous vistas of the future. I believe that this statement goes beyond the singularity is near. This goes much farther, because Sri Aurobindo speaks of the development of the immaterial, not only of the material, but the immaterial, and how the mind can directly seize on the physical energy. And maybe that this also is in the offing, of which not many people are taking into account. But then, what Sri Aurobindo says later, subsequently, the next paragraph, is even more significant. And I should like to continue to read it. Yet, even if he had full knowledge and control of the worlds immediately above matter, there would still be a limitation and still a beyond. The last knot of our bondage is at that point where the external draws into oneness with the internal. The machinery of ego itself becomes subtilized to the vanishing point, and the law of our action is at last unity, embracing and possessing multiplicity, and no longer as now, multiplicity struggling towards some figure of unity. There is the central throne of cosmic knowledge, looking out on her widest dominion. There, the empire of oneself with the empire of one's world. There, the life in the eternally consummate being and the realization of his divine nature in our human existence. These are extremely optimistic statements and fill us with tremendous acceleration of the future, even while we are at present thinking of the impasse and of the perils which are on our path. But as you can see, in this statement, Sri Aurobindo underlines the necessity of breaking the limitations of the egoistic consciousness. So there are two important factors the egoistic consciousness and human tendency to retain egoistic consciousness, and the reason and the limits at which reason has reached, and the tendency to retain those limits. These two factors are biggest blockades in the future evolution of man. And as I said, exactly at this moment, the preoccupation with the preference for the perfection of economic life, a preoccupation which in itself is very important and necessary for the fullness of the totality of completeness, but if it becomes exclusive, predominant as it is now, then, as we saw last time, it marks the reversion to barbarism. And this reversion to barbarism is perhaps one of the greatest perils of our times. This is where we stand. Now, it is at this stage that we find ourselves and we may begin to explore further what is ego, what is reason, and what exactly is this economic organization of life as an aim, and what is humanity today busy with, occupied with? It is these questions that I should like to study with ourselves. Let me first point out that this question of egoism may be regarded as one of the central theme, or one of the central themes, you might say, on which we need to dwell upon first. Usually the word ego is understood by all of us to refer to individuality. Although there is a distinction between the true individual and the egoistic consciousness, as we shall see in due course of time. But in our ordinary parlance, the word ego and the individual are identified. And the whole history of mankind can be conceived in terms of three important terms which are connected with egoism. One, the preoccupation of the ego to develop itself to its maximum. Secondly, while doing so, it has got to interact with collectivity. And the relationship between this ego and the collectivity. And surprisingly, collectivity itself trying to develop to the maximum development point. And the interaction between egoism and the collectivity. The demand of the ego to find its perfect place, its exclusive place perhaps, and collectively trying to swallow up the ego from time to time and as much as it can, and demanding from the ego a complete subservience if possible, and the egoism opposing it from time to time, and sometimes accepting the subservience of the collectivity also from time to time, a kind of equilibrium, disequilibrium play between the ego and the collectivity, and a search for a relationship between the two which could be regarded as ideal. The whole history of mankind can be conceived in these terms of these three movements, and what has been perceived as three perfections. These three perfections have been conceived in the human history. The perfection of the individual, the perfection of the collectivity, and perfection of the relationship between these two. As I said last time, there are many sentences and passages in Sri Aurobindo, which provide the summaries of world history from one point of view or the other. Similarly, I would like to point out to you another passage in the Life Divine, which describes the whole history of mankind very briefly in terms of this problem of the individual and the collectivity and the interrelationship. This is on page number 1046 of the Life Divine, volume number 19 of the Centenary Edition. And it is in the last chapter of the Life Divine, where Sri Aurobindo points out how human race has been swaying between three principal preoccupations of idealism. I read out to you the passage. These sway between the three principal preoccupations of our idealism. The complete single development of the human being in himself, the perfectibility of the individual, a full development of the collective being, the perfectibility of society, and more pragmatically restricted, the perfect or best possible relations of individual with individual and society, and of community with community. Now, Sri Aurobindo goes on to say how, in the history of mankind, these three idealism have swung from one point to the other. And describing this swing, Sri Aurobindo states, an exclusive or dominant emphasis is laid sometimes on the individual, sometimes on the collectivity or society, sometimes on a right and balanced relation between the individual and the collective human whole. One idea holds up the growing life freedom or perfection of the human individual as the true object of our existence, whether the ideal be merely a free self-expression of the personal being or a self-governed whole of complete mind, fine and ample life and perfect body, or a spiritual perfection and liberation. In this view, society is there only as a field of activity and growth for the individual man, and serves best its function when it gives, as far as possible, a wide room, ample means, a sufficient freedom or guidance of development to his thought, his action, his growth, his possibility of fullness of being. An opposite idea gives the collective life the first or the sole importance. The existence, the growth of the race is all. The individual has to live for the society or for mankind. Or even he is only a cell of the society. He has no other use or purpose of birth, no other meaning of his presence in nature, no other function. Or it is held that the nation, the society, the community is a collective being, revealing its soul in its culture, power of life, ideals, institutions, all its ways of self-expression. The individual life has to cast itself in that mold of culture, serve that power of life, consent only to exist as an instrument for the maintenance and efficiency of the collective existence. In another idea, the perfection of man lies in his ethical and social relations with other men. He is a social being and has to live for society, for others, for his utility to the race. The society also is there for the service of all, to give them right relation, education, training, economic opportunity, right frame of life. These are the three idealisms between which humanity has been swayed from time to time. I think if you look at the whole history of mankind, you can ask which period is dominated by which of these three ideals. In recent times, if you examine, there has been too much emphasis in putting the individual at the service of the society, to make collectivity as perfect as possible, even though, as a revolt, individualism also has found a tremendous room, and we have come to a very important tug of war between the individual perfection and collective perfection. People doubt whether ever humanity be able to bring about either of them, whether individual can be perfected, whether society can be perfected, and whether relationship between individual and society can ever be perfected. Once again, rational power of man is utilized and has to be utilized because that is the highest power that man has at present. And the question is whether rationality has the power, has the wisdom, has the key either to individual perfection, social perfection, and relationship between the two. This is the point at which today we find ourselves arrested. And once again, we are required to utilize reason to understand individual, to understand society, and to understand the relationship between individual and society. In doing so, there are many domains of data which need to be explored. And unless we do that, we shall not be able to find a true solution. And the difficulty with the egoism of man and rational powers of man at present have come up with one very important statement. Both agree to inquire. Both show willingness to inquire. But the paradoxical situation is that when the proposals for inquiry are being put forward, both egoism of man and rational powers of man refuse to inquire. I do not know whether this statement would be accepted either by egoism or by rationality of man. But if we inquire into the depth as to why we are not able to make sufficient progress, at the root of it we shall find that while we profess to inquire, we refuse to inquire. There is some kind of a refusal. In fact, you might say that one of the most important problems of humanity today is a refusal. As Mother once said, refusal with R cap. There is a refusal. Now Sri Aurobindo goes farther and says that in breaking this refusal, the lead will have to come from the individual. In fact, according to Sri Aurobindo, it is the individual who has a pivotal significance today. Why, how it should be so, we shall see again later on. But this is a statement that Sri Aurobindo has made, that individual holds a key. And this is why the need that this entire analysis that we are making is addressed to individuals individually. And each individual has to understand it to the best of his or her ability, because it is the individual who has to make a choice. This question of choice is also extremely important. What is the role of choice in the evolution, in the process of evolution, is also an extremely important theme to be explored. But in any case, this being so, I am reminded of the very famous statement of Immanuel Kant. As many of us know, that the speciality of Kant is not merely in his analysis and critique of pure reason, but in his analysis of the individual. And in his analysis of the idea of the free will and the importance of choice. We must remember that Kant lived at a time of the French Revolution. And one of the surprising facts that he witnessed was that an ideal was put forward and a group of people in France made a choice to realize those ideals, as a result of which the situation of pre-revolution was completely overturned and a new era in human history started on a higher level of evolution. The decisive factor was perception of an ideal, and the choice which was made by a few individuals to realize that ideal. Now, Kant pointed out that if there is something most important in the individual, is of course the choice, but he went further, because when we talk of choice, usually we talk of alternatives which are available in an ordinary life, whether I should go on the right-hand side or the left-hand side, because both of them lead ultimately to the same destination. Or there is more pleasure on one side and less pleasure on the other side, and therefore I make a choice on the basis of what gives me greater pleasure. But what Kant pointed out was that apart from this kind of choice, there is a greater choice, a higher level of choice, is a choice of an alternative which is governed by a law. That is to say, you choose between a stage of existence in which there are alternatives, but there are no laws determining what you call, there are only hypothetical laws. If you want this, then this is good choice. If you want this, this is a good choice. But he said that there is another choice available, a law of which he calls the law of the categorical imperatives. And there is a choice available to man whether to accept hypothetical laws or the categorical law. And the real freedom of man lies in the exercise of a choice between this and that. And he found that real individual, that what we call true individuality, is really found, discovered, even the individual finds himself a living being, what you might call existential experience of the individual, when he makes a choice, when he exercises this choice and selects and chooses the operation of the higher law, categorical imperatives. In fact, you might say that one of the greatest contributions of Kant in modern times is his emphasis on the individual, his discovery of the individual, because you must remember that there was a tradition of a thought movement in Europe in which emphasis was laid upon the whole, so that the individual was considered to be part, was reduced only to a position of a cog in a machine. And Kant pointed out that individual is not a cog in the machine. Individual is something quite unique. The whole idea of individual as a responsible being, so that there is a choice, a freedom which is exercised by the individual, gives to the individual a sense of being a channel of a will which is not his own personal will. And this is also very interesting. There is a will which he considered to be universal law, a will of universal law, which expresses itself through the agency of the individual, in which the individual perceives it, makes a choice for it, experiences freedom in it, and feels himself to be a true agent of action and a responsible agent of action. It is true that Kant does not take his analysis to the farthest extent possible, potentialities of the individual, and that even his definition of the categorical imperative and his own treatment of the universal law, they have been rightly criticized by many subsequent thinkers, and there is a great merit in the criticisms which have been subjected to the idea of Kant. We need not go into it actually at present. It's not a part of our present inquiry. What is important, however, is the fact that individual is not a cog in the machine. This idea that individual has something in him which can play a pivotal role, a decisive role, in the development of civilization. This idea, I think, he underlined it, and it is very important that thereafter, in the West, individualism has gained a great momentum on account of this discovery. In fact, you might say that both Romanticism and even postmodernism, both of them have tended to give a greater importance to the individual than to the society. And both have given greater importance also to the operation of will rather than to reason. This is not to advocate a kind of romanticism or postmodernism. It is only to see the merits, whatever merits both these movements possess. And surely in emphasizing the importance of the individual, underlying the freedom of the individual, and the powerful role that individual can play and must play, and the impact it has made upon the present thinking of civilization, this is to be underlined. Nonetheless, the other idea that society is the most important thing, and social perfection is the highest thing to be sought after, even while making individual subservient to the society, is also very, very prominent today. It is true that we speak of democracy, and democracy derives its great value from the importance that is being given to the individual and the freedom of the individual. We must understand that there is an overwhelming attempt to subjugate individual, and that is why even in the fields of democracy, the battle between the individual and the authority is quite acute. This would not be if individual is rightly understood in its true value. There is an uneasy equation today between individual and society, and the overwhelming importance is given to the perfection of the society. In any case, Sri Aurobindo points out that faced with the present situation where we stand today, where economic organization and perfection of economic organization is being pursued vehemently, a situation where huge structures have been built up, and where difficulties are being faced, although the impasse is not felt as an impasse as yet, but still there is a tremendous movement to find some solution. There is no doubt that humanity does find itself in the presence of an enormous difficulty. We speak of bewildering multiplicity of problems which modern mankind is facing today. We may not regard this multiplicity of problems as basically a result of a deeper crisis which Aurobindo calls evolutionary crisis. This diagnosis may not be yet seen by many people, but nobody can deny the fact that today humanity recognizes, acknowledges multiplicity of problems, and that there is a tremendous movement to find solution. Now, in that search of solution, Sri Aurobindo marks out four alternatives which have been put forward in our last century, in the 20th century, in fact. If we examine the whole history of the century, we shall find that it is working out of proposing these four solutions. And it is by examining these four alternative solutions that we can move forward in coming to the grip of the real problem. I would like to invite all our friends to 3 or 4 pages of this last chapter of Life Divine, beginning from page number 1056. Up to page number 1059, where Sri Aurobindo expounds these four solutions. I think the first solution, in fact, Sri Aurobindo says that the overwhelming idea of the first solution was to emphasize the search for perfected economic society. Secondly, this search for a perfected economic society was to be conducted by the powers of reason. and by the powers that science has brought to mankind. But there was a further element. That element was to regard the idea that a community or society or the nation had a soul, and that each nation, particularly one nation, or the nation in which particularly this ideology arose, regarded itself to be a superior soul, where even the concept of the soul was misconceived, and the communal ego was raised up to the status of a soul. And it was felt that if this idea of national subjective being called soul, but actually an ego, if people can be collected together under the force of this impulsion, and if they all come together, then a perfected economic society can be created. This is the formula. In doing so, the effort was to coerce the individual to fall in line with the demands of the communal ego. Now, the other solution had also the same idea of perfected economic society, again with the power of the reason. Again, putting science as the instrument for enlargement of whatever structures and productions that could be produced by science. But the idea was not a communal national egoism, but the whole humanity. It was a kind of a movement in which international community of mankind could join together so that a perfected economic society can be created. But the means are the same, coerce the individual so that they can all come together. An individual, if he opposes, he can be curbed and to fall in line. This is the second solution that was being proposed. A third solution was, as Sri Aurobindo says, the development of an enlightened reason and will of the normal man consenting to a new socialized life in which he will subordinate his ego for the sake of the right arrangement of the life of the community. Here, the consent of the individual was conceded. But the aim is again a perfected economic society. And even ultimately, the teaching was individual should subserve himself for the larger interests of the society, and that this consent can be brought about by education, by training, and by creating a kind of a social machinery. Now, Sri Aurobindo, having studied all the three alternative solutions, in fact, we know now, historically, that all the three solutions have failed. Mm-hmm. And today, we are almost at a point where we do not know in what direction the new development must take place. It is true that after the collapse of Nazism, after the collapse of communism in Russia, in Soviet Union, and after the failure of the developed world, which was capitalistic, which was socialistic partly, and which was partly swaying between the two alternatives, we do not know as yet where to turn. And we are at this point where we are still constructing new theories of social development. And still our preoccupation is the perfection of economic society. To use our reason for that purpose and to use the power of science and creation of huge structures. And the latest development is globalization. And we do not know as yet, you have not experienced how far globalization will take us and what direction, what will be the perils and advantages and disadvantages are being discussed today at large. But there are two, three sentences of Sri Aurobindo which are very relevant, where Sri Aurobindo says that all these solutions rely upon machinery, create social machine, create scientific machines, utilize reason as a machine, utilize individual as a machine. It is machinery that is predominant in our present thinking about social individual relationships. And Sri Aurobindo says, machinery cannot form the soul and life force into standardized shapes. It can at best coerce them, make soul and mind inert and stationary, and regulate the life's outward action. But if this is to be effectively done, coercion and compression of the mind and life are indispensable, and that again spells either unprogressive stability or decadence. In three lines, Sri Aurobindo suggests a true solution. Sri Aurobindo says, man's true way out is to discover his soul and his self-force and instrumentation and replace by it both the mechanization of mind and the ignorance and disorder of life nature. Now, you can see that in Sri Aurobindo's diagnosis, the most important thing is to ask each individual to discover his soul. This is a proposition which needs to be explored. What does it mean? unless there come about individuals in the world in sufficiently increasingly larger number, we cannot come out of present impasse. As Sri Aurobindo pointed out, it is only when the egoism of man can be thinned to the vanishing point that the hugeness of the structures can be met by the hugeness of the individual, and that hugeness of the individual would rest in the soul of man, neither in his power of mind, nor in his power of life, nor in his power of body, but in the power of the soul. What Kant has dimly recognized, the discovery of the individual, the discovery of the individual freedom, individual discovery of a law which is categorical, a discovery which is universal. Universal and therefore something that goes beyond egoism. To go beyond egoism, to remain yet the individual, and to be united with the universal, unless this happens, and unless a large number of individuals come in together, and this consciousness spreads in the world, we may go on knocking the doors after doors, erecting solutions after solutions. The present situation is such that we cannot escape from the present impasse. I think I have spoken at length today beyond my time limit, but let me, within next 2-3 minutes, sum up my present statement, because I spoke of 4 solutions and I have expanded only 3. And I reserve the 4th one for the next one and still develop it further next time. And then I would like to then deal with the problem of reason and also deal with the problem of ego and the individual. Because unless we analyze these terms very neatly, we will not be able to understand the significance of the problem and the solution and the tremendous work that Sri Aurobindo and the mother have accomplished. So I would like to stop here now.
Maybe I can introduce a question in lieu of some of the others, and I'm sure there will be other questions. But I know one of the problems you introduced, the very first problem, that of the hugeness of machinery, and Sri Aurobindo's statement about the vanishing point is a great concern with one of our attendees, Rich Carlson, with whom I've had many conversations on this subject. The question over there has to do with this idea of a vanishing point for machinery. What is very interesting is that indeed, when Sri Aurobindo was writing that particular comment in the 2nd chapter of The Life Divine, we had just embarked upon the whole regime of the disappearance of machinery in a subtle or subtler transmission, telecommunication revolutions. And he's talking about wireless telegraphy over there. But you see, so this question of the vanishing point, which is in a sense something with us today, I mean, we have reached a point where we are ubiquitous all over the world. We can contact anybody at just the push of a button. We take it for granted today. But at the same time, there is an invisible machinery behind it. Though we seem to have, reduced the mechanical sort of devices, the huge machinery has now disappeared. And we are, in a sense,
yes.
you know, being ruled by a variety of conditioning forces that are utilizing this disappearance. You know,
yeah, that's true.
Or people like the Kurzweil are talking about, people like Ray Kurzweil, whom you introduced, are talking about a new kind of biology in which there are implants and all kinds of bionic devices, which we can't see. We see human beings just like human beings. They're so subtle that they have entered into our body. But as a matter of fact, they have provided a certain kind of a circuit within which the free market can operate even more freely. That, in a sense, as you are pointing out, the demise of communism has brought into play this free market in which the individual is not free enough. There isn't enough freedom of choice of the deeper sort, of the impersonal sort, so that individuals are constantly being conditioned by market forces of self-interest and greed. So would you like to comment on that, Kirichi, particularly on this reverse use, this one may say using, I mean, Sri Aurobindo's terminology, an asuric disappearance of theory to the vanishing point is with us today?
But actually, this question that you raise has many aspects. And let me first speak of the present movement of market economy. I take this illustration of market economy because many people believe that market economy is based upon the philosophy of freedom of the individual. Because in market economy, every individual is considered to be free as an entrepreneur. Every individual can enter the market, is to enter the market, and can compete with all the peers, and he make his mark in the society and can succeed and can gain whatever he aims at getting. He can work in the society as it were as a field, but not as a master. Society does not tell him what he should do, how he should do, how he should go about. In that sense, you say that market economy advocates the freedom of the individual. And many people believe that market economy is a kind of an ideal system, and with the collapse of communist system in Soviet Union, people believe that now there is a reassertion of freedom of man, freedom of the individual, freedom of the market development, and therefore humanity now being freed. This is the kind of reasoning which is being put forward. Now, the statement that you made is very important, because the question is, is it really true that in a market economy, individuals are free? First of all, we must know that those individuals who say they are free to enter into markets, if you examine really the claim of those individuals who can really enter into the global markets, are those individuals who have some kind of backing of a system of inheritance. It's a subtle kind of social machinery. If there was no system of inheritance, if there was no law to support inheritance, if there was no machinery of inheritance, then most of the so-called free individuals would not have felt the freedom to enter into the free markets. So that is one machinery which has not been questioned for centuries and centuries, and even in the present time. And the right to property is regarded as sacrosanct, a right which was questioned in the Calvinist philosophy, is now being reasserted in the name of freedom. But we do not realize that this so-called freedom is itself a kind of a machinery. We have a system of inheritance as a result of which property rights are being protected by the society, and society has got to protect it by law. These are all machineries. It is by machinery that some individuals are able to enter into markets, free markets, and begin to play a big role. And other individuals are told, you also are free. How illusory this freedom is for those individuals who watch the big tycoons moving about in the world is really to be seen in realistic terms. They believe that they are free, perhaps. I do not know how far they feel that they are free. It is true that some individuals do feel free and they exercise freedom and they can enter into that larger market by some kind of circumstances and favorable circumstances, hard labor on their part and so on. But can we say that it is the operation of the whole of the Indian society of the principle of freedom? Is every individual equally free to enter into the global markets? Legally, you might say, yes, in law, nobody will prevent him. But what is the condition in which individuals are placed? Are individuals placed in equality by law? Not at all. This is one machinery. Second is a big machinery, market itself. Market is being run by three machineries. One is a machinery by which goods are produced. Secondly, there is a machinery by which goods are distributed. And thirdly, there is a machinery of administration by which this production and distribution are managed. So you have got three machineries. And these three machineries, all of them take advantage of the power of science in regard to productivity. And science itself is an impersonal force which is developing its own way. And there also there are machines by which science is developing. And the march of science individuals also have to be like almost like a machinery. They have to submit themselves to the progression and the direction in which the science is moving today. This also is machinery. And thirdly, the whole world today is greatly organized by a system of administration. Not only economic administration, of which I spoke just now, but administration in every field of activity. There is a political machinery by which leaders are being elected, and we know what kind of machinery is working, and to what extent individuals are free in this machinery. Those who are examining political philosophy of democracy acutely, they have come to the conclusion that this is a pseudo-democracy, or that democracy is the best of all evil forms of government. No, it is best, but it is best of evil forms. And capitalism is regarded as one of the best economic structures, but one of the most evil economic structures, best of the economic structures, which are evil, all of them. So in politics as a machinery, even in regard to healthcare, there is a machinery. In education, there is machinery. In fact, everywhere where we turn today, our life is a timetable ruled life. So what we call freedom of man is hardly there is time even to later to think even. It is everywhere there is machinery. In fact, you touch anywhere your hand and there is machinery. You build a house, we now see called the prefabricated houses. In which everything is pre-designed and machines roll out all that you need for a housing. This is not to deny the fact that there is a vast field of art, creativity, literature, poetry. But even artists today know how much machinery is at work and how much even individual artists find it difficult to really exercise freedom in their own art. So I agree with you that there are various layers of machineries today in which our whole society is encased. And it is against this fabrication of machinery and binding of the society within machineries of various kinds, it is that which reduces the individual to be a cog in the machine. Since, what do you think about these reflections which I presented to you?
Yes, Kiribhai. I absolutely I agree. That really brings to focus this problem of the individual in modern world. And, you know, the tremendous difficulty that is faced by us today in even having time and space to allow the growth of the soul. I just wanted to mention that. And then if anybody else has any questions, please come forward.
I have a question. This is Pika. Given the all the external perfections, like no economic problem and no fights and no agitations. I mean all kinds of perfections, even if we have externally. Do you think that there is still some internal problems like boredom, sense of insecurity, and lack of communication, some kind of sense of gap of in communication, things like that?
Well, you are quite right, Shruti. Our main emphasis is upon the fact that basically individual is a seeker of freedom. It is because of circumstances that he is obliged to submit himself to society and to machinery. Or sometimes he really recognizes the importance of society because there is no doubt about the fact that collectivity is also a reality and collectivity is also a meaning. While speaking of individual freedom and the value of individual, we need not underestimate the importance of the collectivity, the importance of the collectivity, even the need for collective perfection. But while we look upon the present society as a big machine, we do have to reckon the fact that individual is bound to feel suffocated under the press of the machinery. And what you are saying, the problems of boredom, problems of oppression, problems of anxiety, problems of various kinds of competitive forces which are at work, and this feeling of fear of the future, and therefore what we call existential problems, they are rampant today all over the world. And it is for that reason that we need to examine problems more acutely. My problem is that we are not at present, first of all, analyzing the problems more clearly, and we are driven away by the impress of one ism or the other and try to defend one position against the other, and we are not able to arrive at a very synthetic method of looking at things. What I find in Sri Aurobindo so refreshing is a new way of thinking, feeling and acting. And this new feeling, a new way of thinking, is this synthetic way of looking, in which all points of view are synthesized. And I think that, as Sri Aurobindo says, that we have to move towards what he calls whole consciousness, consciousness of integrality. And it's only with the integral vision of things that the problem of the future of society can be resolved. So I agree with you that these problems which you are speaking of, they do exist and they do require a solution.
So in case there's any more hope, do you place the surrender to the divine anywhere here?
Surrender to the divine. When you are raising one of the most important themes, and while I would say yes, certainly yes, and underline it 100 times, but when we speak of surrender, we need to understand this concept in a greater depth than what is normally suggested, because there are many ideas of surrender in religious thought, even in the thought of legal systems, surrender of rights, for example. Then similar ideas of surrender that we find in economics. We find similarly idea of surrender in spiritual life, not religious, but spiritual life. So while I agree with you that certainly the solution would lie in the surrender to the divine, I would say that we need to understand in greater depth what we really mean by surrender to the divine. So, if you like to ask something further on this, we can build upon it, but otherwise, certainly it's a question which you shall have time to discuss in due course of time when we come to find out how egoism, for example, can be led to its vanishing point. And there, the idea of surrender to the divine is very relevant. And we shall have certainly a great deal to say about this matter.
I have a question.
Yes. If we speaking?
Yes. Oh, thank you. It's Vincent Massa.
Yes.
I just wanted to know if that last chapter, Sri Aurobindo's book, is one that he worked on, or did he just, did he amend it in the course of his life, or is it all written between 1914 and 1921?
I don't know exactly. You are asking whether Sri Aurobindo came to these anayas. No. Please continue. No? Can you repeat your question?
Yes. Did Sri Aurobindo work these thoughts in public this chapter or work on this chapter at the end of his life, or was it completed earlier?
Oh, you want to say whether
the last chapter?
No, I know that Sri Aurobindo wrote basically between 1914 and 1921, but many chapters were added later on. And therefore, I cannot say that what I read out to you was written in 1914 and 1921, excepting I am quite sure that what was written in chapter number 2 was certainly between 1914 and 1915. It was one of the earliest essays he wrote in the Life Divine. But later on, when he comes to this, discuss the problem of divine life and this problem of modern times, contemporary times, I think it was at a later stage. But I do not know what exactly later stage means when. I don't know whether we have sufficient data to be very sure about it. So perhaps Debashish may be able to answer this question. Debashish, can you shed light on this question?
Kiriji, yes, you are right. I think the 6 chapters were revised later by Aurobindo.
Yes.
In the last, towards the 1940s, as I'm told. I'm also not 100% sure what exactly he added. The people in the archives have been studying these things, and maybe some answer be obtained from some of the people over there. This last chapter that you're was certainly, certainly edited by Sri Aurobindo. Hmm. In the 1940s and maybe even around the time of the Second World War, in that period.
Mm, yes. Yes.
Well, thank you.
Would you like to ask Archive sometime? Because this question seems to be a very interesting question. Even from a historical point of view, if you could raise this question to the Archive and send them this question, and maybe next time if you can get an answer on this question, it will be quite interesting for all of us.
All right. I will certainly ask the question.
That will be good, huh? Thank you.
I also, I don't know if this is a question, but I was reading about this transmission. The latest thing at MIT was wireless transmission of energy. And I thought it was a great breakthrough and would lead to a lot of things. Like I imagined in my head a lot of electric cars being driven around with no need of battery. But then I realized that it's not really a breakthrough and that it would also mean a tremendous increase in mechanization in the power transmitted would probably be very destructive if you were in the way of it. And it's like in my thinking, it was like a dead end. And so I realized that that's connected to the vanishing point of mechanization, or it's like the opposite of that. And I don't know, I just felt a sense of despair. Read that, or that. I can see what Sri Aurobindo is being at. I wish we'd get to that vanishing point. So,
I think there is what Sri Aurobindo was suggesting was that in wireless telegraphy we get freedom in transmission, although there is a kind of a limitation at the point of impulsion and the point of perception. And so envisaging is a possibility of even eliminating these two points, impulsion and reception. And particularly the discovery of the energy to work in the immaterial. We are still at the level, we have not yet crossed the area of the material. We have not yet sufficiently entered in immaterial, although all the present movements and speed with which we are able to communicate and so on, certainly takes us to the borderline where the material and immaterial meet together. But still, according to Aurobindo, the newer sciences are still to develop. When the science of life world, science of mind world, will be discovered and how to utilize them, it's a great period of development is ahead. But how much freedom, even then, from machinery you will get, there is still a question mark, because freedom can be obtained only by freedom from egoism. It is not a development of powers and energies and all kinds of structures which are necessary, but real freedom is obtained only when there is this realization of the freedom from egoistic limitation.
Oh, thank you.
Regards the freedom from egoism and especially vis-a-vis the machinery that is sort of become sort of the main sort of preoccupation of modernity or post-modernity, it seems like this machinery, we could talk about probably two evolutions, one sort of internal that Aurobindo was referring to, and one external, which sort of progresses, perhaps like McLuhan says, everything, we're outering sort of our inner propensities. So the wheel becomes the outering of the foot, clothes the outering of the skin. The central nervous system is sort of outered in sort of mass communication technology. And so with this outering of technology, it seems to me this sort of works contrary to this innering of centering ourselves with the being. It doesn't seem like outering the psychic being is sort of one of the items on the agenda of modernity and its sort of evolution. And if that is so, Aurobindo warns that this sort of method leads to sort of an aggrandizement of the ego. And towards the end of Life Divine, we haven't got there, he speaks of the coming of the Nietzschean type of Superman. And possibly he says at the worst, the reign of the blonde beast or the dark beast or any and every beast,
yeah.
A return to barbaric and ruthlessness and force.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering how we sort of, aspiring for inner evolution as sort of vanishing point of the ego, rather than the vanishing of the human into the machine, which leads to this sort of will to power, will to technology that is driving modernity. I'm just wondering if you see sort of a dialogue or a relationship of how one sort of on the path of an inner evolution then sort of encounters this whole machinery of this outer evolution.
I think your question is very, very difficult to answer, but let me show some points which we can discuss further. The first point is that there is always a process in this world, and there is a law of the process. Only there are levels of these processes, and therefore different laws of process. And these processes are more and more flexible as we go from material plane to higher planes of existence. To come out of the binding or the bondage to the process is a process by which one can stand, a capacity to stand behind the process. That is why a great importance is given to the development of witnessing consciousness. But even that is only a step. At a higher level, there must be a will which can utilize the process according to the need or according to whatever is at hand in view. And therefore, in that sense, what you spoke of psychic being is really important. It is the discovery of the psychic being which is both capable of witnessing and also willing and which can control the processes. These concepts are to be put together in a kind of a neat relationship. We had in India, right from the concept of Swarajya, and then the concept of Samrajya. That is to say, you rule yourself, and if you rule yourself, you can rule the whole world. And the secret of it was the vanishing point of the egoism, as a result of which psychic being can be released from the bondage, and it can exercise its own free will to utilize machinery or the processes and the levels of processes which are available freely to the individual. So this is somehow an answer that I can give temporarily, although I would admit that your question is very vast and admits of levels of answer. But if you have further thing to say, I'll be happy to hear you once more.
I think we are at the end of our period for today, and some of our guests who, do other things. We are at 8:30 in the United States in the Pacific Coast. Submitting ourselves to the machineries of modernity. So I think with this we could come to an end, and the pretty large scope of this lecture, Giridhar, and also of
yes.
the question and several of the questions asked will still remain with us,
yes.
and we can
yes.
Explore them further. I'm sure you will have them in your mind as we continue our study next week.
Yes,
at the same time.
Right, we shall do that. Huh?
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Huh?